collecting the stories of Maine's papermaking communities and looking to the future. The news headlines over the past decade or so paint a pretty bleak picture for Maine's paper industry. So many mills have closed or downsized, and so many communities have been affected. But focusing on those headlines obscures a bigger story, that Maine's paper industry remains a huge part of Maine's economy, worth $8.5 billion in 2016. It's also a major part of Maine's cultural landscape. Not only does paper define many communities, but also thousands of Maine people are connected to the mills through parents, grandparents, brothers, and sisters. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The Maine Historical Society and Maine Memory Network have teamed up to explore that personal, cultural connection to the paper industry with an exhibit and online project. Today on Maine Calling, we learn more from historians and papermakers. And we'd love to hear your stories. That's next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. People have been making paper in Maine for almost 300 years. At their peak, paper mills in Maine employed more than 18,000 people. Today, it's a fraction of that. A current exhibit and online project looks at how the paper industry has affected individuals, community, and more in Maine. And we're going to talk about that today. In the studio with me, Donna Cassesi. Did I pronounce it right?
That's correct.
Excellent. Managing Director of Wood Resource Strategy at SAPI North America. And Steve Bromage is the Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a story of a friend or relative who worked in the paper mills? Maybe you did. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, both of you. Steve, tell me about the program. Tell me about the show at the Maine Historical Society.
Sure. Well, to start, it really grows out of the context. At Maine Historical Society, we're really focused on how history can help frame contemporary issues and provide perspectives for what's going on in the state today. So it grows out of that. I think really only part of our work is to look backwards. But history really has a lot of resources and assets and things that it can provide to us that can really enrich life today. And that, I think that's particularly important as we approach the bicentennial in 2020. So with that as a little background, moving to the exhibit, as you suggested, for 125 years, the paper industry really was a cornerstone of the Maine's economy. It shaped the state's culture, and it was really essential to the identity of countless people and communities around the state. So it's a really important aspect of who Maine has been over all this time. I think, like probably many of your listeners, at MHS, we've watched with great pangs over the last number of years as a number of paper mills have closed and seen how communities have been affected. You know, just in the last 5 or 6 years, mills have closed in Millinocket and East Millinocket, Lincoln, Old Town, Bucksport, Madison. For us, we've had some, I think it was the statewide angst has been exacerbated because we've worked very closely with a number of these communities through our Maine Memory Network. It's our online digital museum, and we've worked very closely with communities like Lincoln and Rumford to help them collect their stories over the years. So in addition to the statewide and the local economic impact, you know, these are friends and neighbors, and we really wanted to do something to help kind of recognize the contributions those communities had made to the state over time. So I think that's the big picture background for
it. And a big part of this project, you mentioned the Maine Memory Network, is collecting stories. And Donna, you are one of the stories collected in this really great online resource. There's a video. And what I learned from it, you know, so many people in Maine who work in the paper industry have worked in the paper industry for generations, were following their father or their uncle or somebody into the industry. That was not the case for you, was it?
That was not me. I was born and brought up in the Bronx when I came to the University of Maine at Orono to study
the forest.
Forestry. My first class was identifying trees, and the only thing I could identify was that they were Christmas trees, and almost got thrown out of the program as a result of that, but I managed to graduate 4 years later.
Oh, my goodness. And you've had a career where you've gone back and forth from forestry to the paper side, the manufacturing side. What would you say about those 40 years? What do you feel as though people don't understand about what it's like to be in the paper industry?
how exciting it is. It really is, and it still is. You know, we're not going to write ourselves off right now. We're still $8.5 billion industry. 27% of Maine's total exports are still forestry related. There are 15,000 direct jobs in the industry, with 30,000 if you include the indirect jobs. So we are still a force, and we're still fun, and I would still today recommend anyone who's interested in the sciences to come in and be forester, be a chemical engineer, just a great place still to be. There's a lot of exciting opportunities in the industry, and I think our best years are still to come with some new ideas.
And isn't that interesting? Because, you know, it really has been discouraging as we've watched the headlines over the last decade. Steve, you named the mills that have closed just in the last 5 years, but you see opportunity.
I definitely see opportunity. We're the most forested state in the country, 90%. 90% is privately owned. Skilled workforce, whether it be loggers, papermakers, engineers, University of Maine has a world-class R&D, world-class forestry and engineering program. If you think about where we're located for Northeast markets, Maine is very heavily forested and close to the biggest population. So there are so many opportunities for us to grow. We have packaging, tissue, biofuels. Why make jet fuel out of corn? Why don't we eat it? And instead, we can make that out of wood, biochemicals, nanocellulose. I think our time is really very exciting as we look into more value-added products from the forest than we have had before.
All right. Well, Steve, back to the Maine Memory Network, of which Donna is a part. We're going to listen to a clip, another clip from the Maine Memory Network. This is Bruce Dyke, who worked at the International Paper Mill in Androscoggin for 39 years.
That was where the money was around here. You know, for a guy like me that didn't have a big education, high school education, and end up walking out of there with 6 weeks vacation, sitting in an air-conditioned room for 4 out of 8 hours a night and making $70,000 a year, that was a pretty good job. Yeah, lived here all my life, born in Farmington, lived in Wilton, all of it. Yeah, had three children, all grew up there, went to school, done very well, and you know, it was a great place to bring children up. You know, it's sad to see what's happened to the paper industry. You know, it's an awful change here, what we were all brought up with. You know, it's hard to tell. I mean, I said 10 years ago, you'd never see a new paper machine in the state of Maine. And they've built two or three, and they're talking to building one in Rumford right now.
Steve, when you listen to the clip from Bruce Dyke, what do you think about?
Yeah. Well, I think when you see a state and industry going through a historic transition like we're seeing, it's a really sensitive moment, and it's really important that you there's a lot of change, there's a lot of things happening. I think it's really important that you pause to preserve and capture and honor that history that's been there. So as mills close, as people move away, as people sell houses, there's a lot of historical material that's at risk that's really important to look at and capture. And there's also, again, honoring the perspectives of these folks. One of the neat things about this new tool we have on Maine Memory Network, My Maine Stories, it gives anybody in Maine the ability to share their Maine experience and story. And one of the neat things about this process, we've probably collected about 20, 25 papermaker stories, is just to honor the expertise, the knowledge, the experience of the folks who have seemed to be really appreciative of that.
Donna, when you hear Bruce Dyke, who worked for almost 40 years in the paper mills, say that with only a high school education making $70,000 a year, those days are done, right?
Those days are not done.
Really?
I'll say that the typical wage for someone who has a high school education who's coming into the mill as a papermaker or some of those other areas, we average about $60,000 a year. I'll also say that our age class in terms of experience in the industry, there are a number of us boomers who are going to be retiring. And so there are actually many opportunities still to get jobs. I used to be the Westbrook Mill manager 3 years ago. And when I left, the year I left, we hired 10% of our workforce that year because we had so many retirements. So there are still great opportunities in the industry. There's not as many as there were. And we certainly feel sad for those communities who don't have those jobs anymore. But people who are interested in the industry, there's still jobs, and there's still incredibly well-paying jobs with benefits.
Are we seeing people move from one Maine community to another and follow the opportunities?
Absolutely. We have been really fortunate at SAPI, as an example, to be able to hire some people with tremendous experience from mills, towns that have closed down. And so we're just very grateful that we get the benefit of their experience and they still have an opportunity to work in our industry.
Steve, the exhibit that is up at the Maine Historical Society is only through the end of this month, correct?
Yeah.
What will one see if we walk in?
Yeah, well, the nice thing in this day and age, what you see in the exhibit is really just the tip of the iceberg of the stories and materials we've collected. It's a lot to cram 125 years of statewide history into one small, modest gallery, which Donna has seen. So what we really have tried to do there is provide a very high-level overview of the impact and why that industry has worked so well in Maine. And it's funny, listening to Donna's, you know, tales about the opportunities going forward, you know, you fast forward back to when the paper industry really got going in the 1880s and 1890s, the lumber industry in Maine had kind of stabilized and was probably on the decline, and entrepreneurs and leaders were looking for other opportunities. That coincided with the rise of, you know, the industrialization of the country, the rise of newspapers and literacy, and there was this tremendous demand for paper. And people saw, they were looking, you know, for thousands of years, people got the fibers for paper from cotton. There was no longer a supply for that. And so all of a sudden, folks said, we've got trees. Trees are made of fiber. So, it was a technological advancement. It was science. And it was an understanding that Maine had some unique competitive assets that could really be mobilized to kind of grow the state's economy based on those trees.
Donna, Steve is mentioning newsprint. He's mentioned, and I know that a big product in Maine's past has been toilet paper, tissue, paper towels. What are the big products in paper in Maine today, and what will be the big products in the future?
Yeah, very interesting question, Jennifer. Maine, more than most states in the country, was very reliant on printing and publishing paper, and so that's one of the reasons why Maine took such a big hit with the mills. In terms of the growth opportunities right now, there really are so many. Tissue, believe it or not, is still a growth industry, hence the $120 million investment in Woodland. Packaging, you probably heard that SAPI is investing $165 million into one of our paper machines at the Somerset Mill. We're going to be able to swing back and forth between printing and publishing and packaging. For all of you who buy from Amazon, that is definitely a growth industry. Very excited about the opportunities to take wood and make high-value products. So you talk about making paper out of rags, and then you made them out of wood. Well, guess what? You can make jet fuel out of wood. So there are so many opportunities there for us to get involved in those growth industries. And one of the things that's been really exciting is our congressional delegation in Maine has been really forward-thinking and has given us an opportunity to work on a forest economy growth initiative in which we're going to take some of the leading world consultants and say, where is Maine competitive? Where should we be attracting industry? You know, Governor LePage is doing a great job working on lower energy costs, which are important to our industry. So we really feel like we have a lot of people giving us attention and really looking forward to what's the next big thing, from rags to printing and publishing to jet fuel, right?
So you mentioned jet fuel. In the future, will we even call it Maine's paper industry? Within the industry, do you still call it the paper industry or something else?
We still do. I think it's now going to be known as the forest economy. And so we're just thinking about all those different products that we can get out of wood. I just looked last week. I was up at the University of Maine, and there's a nanocellulose that they're using that's actually 97% water, and it's solid like face cream is. And so there's all kinds of excitement about cosmetics, that you could put the cream on your face. If it's 97% water, even my wrinkles might go away.
Oh, my goodness. So, and I should mention that Maine Calling is traveling to Aroostook County next week, and Tuesday's program will be on Maine's forest products industry. So tying that together with today's program, we're talking with Steve Bromage and Donna Cassese about Maine's paper industry, and we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, post on Facebook, or call us if you'd like to talk about your experience or your relatives in the paper industry. Our number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. How has the way that paper companies are managed changed the industry? You work at Sappi, which was famously founded by Mr. Warren, who was a visionary. But now so many paper mills are owned by really investment firms. And what does that do to the industry?
Everyone has their own story in terms of the industry. I can tell you for Sappi that we're very focused on research and development and innovation. And so as you look at the products, the Westbrook Mill makes release paper, which is then used to make soccer balls and all kinds of other very innovative products. I think that the key in the industry is to do your R&D, to be willing to innovate, and very importantly, is to invest. And so the companies who are investing both in their workforce and in their capital equipment and also investing in R&D, that really is the future. And we are very fortunate in Maine to have the resources at the University of Maine at Orono that are helping all of us really to look towards new products in the future.
Steve, was there a turning point when you look at sort of macro history, if that's a thing, when market forces changed the paper industry in Maine?
Well, I think there's been a constant evolution. So back to your observation about kind of offshore ownership of Maine paper companies. In fact, that's been the case since relatively early on. You know, the capital in the 1880s and 90s and early 1900s to build those paper mills came largely from out of state. It was often managed by local people. But a lot of that investment, which is a common theme in Maine's economic history. Places like Millinocket and Rumford were literally, these communities were built and grew around these mills.
Sure, you know, they were just built to serve Millinocket.
That's right. Indeed. And, you know, one of the great things you see in the exhibit, we have the first piece of paper that came off the first machine there in around 1900. It's a pretty cool little artifact. But, and I think, you know, so these, it's amazing to the extent to which the Maine woods were industrialized, and these principles and models that worked in different industries were laid on top of the on the Maine woods. And it's fascinating to see how you can as efficiently as possible survey the woods, know what the kinds of trees there, know what you can produce from them. How do you quickly and efficiently get them to the mill and processed and out of here? So I think through the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there was just strong leadership in the national kind of industry for there. I think Donna's points about investment is very important, because I think there were periods of times in the 20s and 30s where investment was pretty conservative, and there were opportunities where had more investment been made in the mills and you'd had more modern facilities, you could have really extended the dominance of Maine paper in the world.
And the competition. I mean, back in the day, our competition would have been Wisconsin. Now it's China. Right. So the world players, really, the globalization has really made a very big difference. And again, the dynamics of the products. And so if market for printing and publishing or newspapers is going down, again, the need to reinvent and to think about what we can do and possibly come up with products that are even higher value than what we've produced in the past, I think is something very real for Maine.
Yeah.
Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation and we'll have your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. And on Wednesday, October 18th, Maine Public Radio and the Maine Calling team will host a reception at the Campus Center Ballroom in the Allagash Room at the University of Maine at Presque Isle from noon to 1 p.m. just before the live show. Space is very limited and must be secured in advance by emailing rsvp@mainepublic.org. Again, that's rsvp@mainepublic.org. We hope you can join us, and thanks.
Tristan Harris once had a successful career in Silicon Valley trying to manipulate your attention. And then he became disenchanted.
And so you started to see technology not as a vehicle for improving people's lives, but really as a means to persuade people to do things.
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about manipulation? That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
You can hear the TED Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 1 on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the past, present, and future of Maine's paper industry. In the studio with me, Donna Cassese. She is Managing Director of Wood Resource Strategy at SAPI North America. And Steve Bromage is the Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us is Michael Crowley. He's the Executive Director of Our Katahdin. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity.
Tell us about Our Katahdin. What is its mission, and what progress have you seen?
Sure. Our Katahdin was established 3 years ago by six very creative people who, like many of us who are from this community, from this region, experienced the pain, either Longdens or for those who remain here, very much every day a part of their lives. And none of us were and are willing to sort of toss in the towel, but there was no apparent plan of action, a call to arms, if you will, to assume responsibility and control of our destiny. Our Katahdin did that in a very seemingly small way, and it was to establish a social media platform where the community identified key areas that were important to the community for their own emotional, personal, as well as aesthetic benefit. That started in Millinocket. It has grown, and it is catching on into the entire Katahdin region, which includes not only Millinocket, but East Millinocket, Medway, Mount Chase, Patton, Benedicta, and Sherman. So that is sort of the service area, the focus at the moment for Our Katahdin. The mission is really to look at building the next generation economy for this region. And if there's a single word to define that, it would be diversity. While we would all love to have the paper industry return in some form here, we recognize that unlike the past century, we are in the driver's seat. So Our Katahdin has been focusing on basically three areas to build a resilient economy. The forest economy, I mean, we are right here, contiguous to the largest wood basket in the Northeast. Recreation economy, tourism with the beautiful Mount Katahdin and National Monument, Baxter State Park, designated areas here. We have opportunities that we've yet to optimize to benefit the region. And then the digital economy. Those three really constitute an area of focus. Probably the hallmark of the past 3 years has been the acquisition of the former Great Northern Paper Company West properties located in Millinocket. That is now the property owned by Our Katahdin. In the past 9 months, we have done assessments. We have a pro forma on concepts that would work there, and we are in dialogue with several companies that would optimize location adjacent to the wood basket, but also the abundant availability of energy, electricity, as well as water. That really is the beginning of a game-changing opportunity for this community to really have some control over its own destiny.
Michael, thank you so much, and good luck to you. Steve or Donna, do you have any thoughts for Michael?
Yeah, what I think is so interesting about what they're doing at Our Katahdin, you know, I think the answer for Maine, you know, well, first, you know, the changes in the paper industry aren't unique to that industry. You know, across the state, region by region, community by community, we're having to look at what does Maine's next economy look like and what are the opportunities for those communities. And again, it's interesting when you look historically, every one of these communities in Maine has thrived at some moment in time. And that's because somebody saw an opportunity based on a knowledge of the markets and local assets, and they built businesses, and around that business, an industry and a community grew. So it meant something to make shoes in Skowhegan and to can sardines in Eastport. You know, really regional identity happens. So I think that's one of the things that Maine communities need to do. What are each individual's opportunities going forward? And that's going to look different in different parts of the state. I mean, you look at Westbrook, which was a mill town in Sappy, and they now have IDEX's headquarters. The opportunities are going to look different in every community, but I think it's amazing the way our Katahdin is very consciously looking at that and working to develop a vision and a plan.
I really support the idea of diversity, and I think that is just a very smart move. and the Maine's Forest Economy Growth Initiative, we're also working hand-in-hand with these communities to try to get support and help for their really great mission that they've got for their towns.
Well, Michael Crowley, thank you so much for calling in today. Michael Crowley, the Executive Director of Our Katahdin. We're going to go, well, let's see, I'm going to go next to a tweet. This is from Jim. He writes, is there a particular species of tree that is considered most profitable, and how is the industry ensuring this species' future?
Good question. I would say that, you know, if you look at the hierarchy of value for trees, certainly saw logs are the highest value. And if a typical landowner has a harvest on their property, they get most of their money from the saw logs.
So the saw log is a log that will go into a sawmill to be turned into boards.
Correct.
So not a particular species, but something high enough quality.
Exactly. So it really does go across a number of species, but the ultimate value would typically be from that. Although, again, as we look towards the future, we might be able to make very high value products out of things like biomass, which would be a very low quality tree. And the idea is to try to get that value add from a cheaper source.
We'll go to Michael in Orono. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm actually up in Orono. I'm up here at the Maine Foundation, UMO Foundation luncheon, but I actually live in Western Maine, out in Strong on the other side of Farmington, right in the heart of the Western Maine paper industry.
Where it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just calling in. You know, you were talking about some of the history of the paper industry in Maine and experience with it. I'm retired now, just retired, and I'm a third-generation paper maker, actually a fourth generation if you consider my great-grandfather, who migrated from Quebec. But my grandfather was born in Maine, ended up migrating into upstate New York in the early part of the century looking for work, ended up in the paper industry, and eventually migrated down to Niagara Falls, worked in a paper mill in Niagara Falls, New York, which is where I was born, and my father worked in the paper industry his life, came back to Maine in the 60s when they built a new mill, the Androscoggin Mill, which is now Verso, and I attended schools locally, graduated from the Pulp and Paper Foundation, Pulp and Paper Program at the University of Maine, and spent the next 40 years in the paper industry, both in Maine and around the country. But I'm the last one. None of my kids really work in the paper industry per se, although I do have a son who works for an allied industry, and he actually works for a company that does business over at Sappy in Skowhegan.
Yay. Michael, did you discourage or encourage your kids from going into the paper industry, or neither one?
Well, neither one. I encourage them to look for whatever opportunities they could find. I think the opportunities in Maine are less than they used to be. I mean, that's obvious. I don't think that could be disputed. And working in the paper industry can be difficult work. I mean, it's one of the reasons it pays as well as it does is that it can be hot and dangerous and so on and so forth, and long hours and this kind of thing on the downside of it. But again, it's a good way to make a living. But I think they saw, the handwriting on the wall. They saw, the work that I was doing and what was happening to the mills in Maine and so on and so forth. And they decided to branch out into other areas. So.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for calling and sharing your story. We're going to go to an email now. This is from Randall. He writes, you've got to be kidding me. Paper industry sold their dams and woodlands, sold out their workforce, tax credits for alternative energy, burning black liquor that put unfair competition between mills within companies like Verso Bucksport and Jay, Wausau, Wisconsin with pulp mills, and Wausau Jay without. Mr. Dyke didn't mention the scab workforce that International Paper created. None of these, Donna, none of these companies that he's mentioning are where you work. But there is a history that has, or you want to talk about this, Steve, that has more than one side.
Yeah, I think we have Mike Luciano who's going to call in a couple of minutes, and I think he's got some really great perspective on that because he's lived and he participated through that history, and he has, I think, a unique perspective on both sides of those labor issues and how that's evolved. So I think that's a good one to have him address.
Okay, and we do have him calling in just a little bit. Yeah. Let's see here. We'll go to Byron calling from Rumford. Hi, Byron. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love the show. And I love this topic. I grew up in Rumford It was a great community. It still is a great community. I'm thrilled that the mill is still operating there, and I actually have a good friend of mine who recently took a job there, so that's been a good sign. But I'm fascinated with what's been discussed about opportunities in the paper industry now, and I'm just curious if maybe Laura can speak a little bit about how the industry is going about attracting young professionals to the paper industry, maybe not just out of high school, but college graduates, and what the industry is doing in that respect.
All right, Donna, is recruiting a challenge?
Recruiting is definitely a challenge. And one of the things that we've done is we've actually done some videos from recent recruits into the industry, and those have been very powerful. So, for example, for someone who wants to go to a community college and get a two-year degree in being a mechanic, being a millwright, being a piper, being an electrician, those folks come out of school with really very little, if any, debt. They can go into the paper industry and they can make very, very competitive salaries. And as many of them say, come into work every day trying to solve problems and how challenging that is. But we have to work at it. And as one of your callers said, you know, when you read all the gloom and doom in the newspaper, you can think, well, there really isn't any opportunities there. Every single one of the chemical engineers at the University of Maine's Pulp and Paper Foundation program got a job this year. And so there still are very good opportunities there. And it's really incumbent on us in the industry to make sure we talk about the positive opportunities.
All right. Well, we do have Mike Luciano on the phone with us now. He's from Livermore Falls and spent more than 40 years working in the paper industry. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Did you hear our question? Yeah. Did you hear our question earlier? Somebody called and was frustrated, I think, that our conversation seemed to be so positive because he, you know, was looking at some of the labor issues and some of the things that he saw that paper industry had done that was not so, in his view, ethical over the last few decades. Did you hear that? And did you have thoughts on it?
I did hear that. And I used to have a sign in my office because most of my career was as a human resource director. And I had a sign in my office that culture eats change for breakfast. During the strike, I had worked in the mills in finance and payroll.
Ooh, let me stop you. Which strike are you talking about?
The International Paper Strike of 1987.
Okay, go ahead.
So at that time, I was working in the mill as a setup foreman, but when the strike happened, I left. Because I kind of had an insight on what was going to be going on. And the strike changed the communities pretty much forever. And some people had a negative on the replacement workers because they were losing their jobs. Most people got back in. I chose not to go back because I took a different career path. But the communities did change during that time. And the feelings, even though it was a long time ago, are still around.
What do you think about the paper industry today? Where do you hope your community will be as it and the industry continues to change?
I think Donna hit it on the head, and it needs to diversify. It needs to get into more specialty. The big products now, as she said, the towel and tissue, liner board for boxes. I know Sappy's even doing work in the Midwest with fluff pulp, which is used for diapers and Depends and things like that, and that's a growing product line, especially for us boomers. So it's got to diversify. The publication gloss that we used to make at the mills that I worked at, you no longer see the big Sears catalog and the JCPenney catalog or the thick magazines that we all used to read. Since digitization, that product has really oversupplied, so the demand is not there as it was.
Just a quick correction is at our mill in Minnesota, it's actually dissolving pulp rather than fluff
pulp.
Yeah.
Not that anyone else knows the difference. Mike, before we let you go, any thoughts on today's conversation or what you hope people understand about the paper industry, both historical and in the future?
One thing that I want to say about Donna Cassese, she's one of the people that kind of broke the ceiling. When I recruited early in my career, it was primarily men who were the engineering students coming out of Orono. The last time that I recruited, I recruited many more women engineers than I did men. So that's the changing face of the industry, and I think it's been for the better.
Mike, you're a class act. We know why you were in HR. Thank you.
Mike Luciano, thanks so much for joining us. Mike spent more than four decades in the paper industry, calling us from Readfield today. Thank you, Mike. And we do have to take another short break, but we want to have a word about our programs next week. I mentioned this, that we will be broadcasting from Aroostook County. Four programs, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. The public is invited to come watch all four programs. There's information on our website. On Wednesday, though, something else, and even more special, a luncheon with me and a few Maine Public co-workers in Presque Isle in the Campus Center Ballroom right before the program from noon to 1 p.m. If you will be in the Presque Isle area and want to join us next Wednesday, please RSVP, send an email to rsvp@mainepublic.org. Thank you. Hope to see you there, and we will be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As does Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
On the next Planet Money, we meet a guy whose house has been flooded three times in 3 years, and the federal government has paid to keep him there.
If this was an insurance company, they would be bankrupt.
And on How I Built This, we meet Sarush Alvi, the man who launched the Vice Media Empire after stumbling into a career as a reporter and a writer.
Join us for Planet Money,
followed by How I Built This from NPR.
That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Maine Public Radio. And this afternoon at 2 o'clock...
A frequent traveler to New England towns and cities sees promise in their history and in their bones.
There is something special that pre-exists in the bones of the downtowns. I saw them digging into history and then building the future out of that history and doing a really beautiful job.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, an artist imagines a new future for some very old places and the people who live there. Please join us.
That's on Next, coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine's paper industry. Joining me today, Steve Bromage, the executive director of the Maine Historical Society, where there is an exhibit about the paper industry up until October 28th. And Donna Cassesi is here, too. She's managing director of Wood Resource Strategy at SAPI North America. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Steve calling from Orono. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, great show. And background, my grandfather was a logging operator out of Island Falls, Adiah Brook, and in 1900, 10, 20, raised 10 kids. He migrated, him and my grandmother, from New Brunswick, and he made the most money he ever made in his entire life during the Depression. So the wood industry was pretty darn good for him in the even in the Depression. But my question is, along those lines, is a Canadian company called Cascade. We call it Cascades here in the States. They seem to have like a different kind of partnership with the Canadian government as opposed to the United States government in manufacturing here or even in Maine, where they upgrade their technology. Certainly, they are very profitable. I believe they have mills operating in the U.S. And so my question is about investment. I mean, the Canadian government continues, for example, the Canadian Railroad that Bill Gates is the major owner. They just updated that he can have more ownership of the Canadian Railway. So it's like the Canadian government is more progressive than the U.S. or the state of Maine in supporting, you know, in a private public partnership.
Good question, Steve. Do either of you have thoughts about the difference between how the Canadian government works with its paper industry and ours?
I think, Jennifer, I would broaden that out and say that really we're competing globally, and so across the globe, different countries have different levels of incentives and investments. Actually, one of the things we'll be looking at as part of the Forest Growth Initiative is really to compare Maine and how we attract investment compared to either other states or other places in the world. So I think there's some good learning for us there, and we need to take a look at that to understand how we can be more competitive.
Steve, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to Chris, who has a Facebook post. What advances have the paper companies made to reduce toxicity of the papermaking process?
Continuous improvement. We have poured millions of dollars into the mills in terms of creating a more sustainable platform. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips right now, but certainly could get numbers. But I think if you take a look at any of the mills and you take a look at the positive incremental improvement in an environmental record, it's something to be really proud of.
All right. And we'll go to Brad, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a suggestion, and that is one of the problems with the mills closing down is the ownership. When it's owned by an investment company whose only concern is making maximum profits, we have things like the Gates Mill in Winslow Clothing, the mill in Bucksport, and then they sell it off for scrap. Versus the situation in Ontario or Quebec, where the mill was closing, and instead of that happening, the loggers and the workers and the community bought the mill, and now that mill is thriving and creating even more job opportunities than they had before. So we should be looking at ownership. And if the loggers want to keep their businesses going, perhaps they should look at forming organizations that own the mills.
Brad, thank you so much. I know that probably more than a decade ago, there was an effort across the border in the Berlin area to have locals own the mill, and it didn't work out.
Yeah. I mean, I think any kind of ownership can work. The important part is, do you have a market? Is it a growth market? Do you have the money to invest? And those are really the recipes for success, no matter who the owner is.
Brad, thanks for your call. We have Mary on Facebook writes, I hope you have seen Monica Woods play Papermaker. Monica is our favorite guest here on Maine Calling. And Steve, I just want to ask you, both her books about growing up in a mill town and also the play, what kind of difference has that made for the community of people who are connected with Maine's paper mills?
Well, I think both the play and When We Were the Kennedys just are such evocative pictures of the rich communities and culture that grew up around these. And we haven't talked too much about that today, but I think that's such an important part of the role of the paper industry in Maine is the identity of these communities. And that was reflected in all sorts of ways. You know, within each mill, there were different levels of expertise and people owned and were innovative in every part of the operations. Then these communities really had temperaments. You know, in Millinocket, for example, and other places with that big paper industry ownership of the woods, they provided access and leases for camps and cabins. And so you're making a good living and you can have time off and you can go recreate in the woods. You know, it was a really rich life people could live around these mills. And I think Monica's books and her work is just so evocative of the spirit and the humanity of these communities. So I think that's what really stands out to me. What she did was kind of put that human face on it.
Yeah, the family connections are great. Mm-hmm. The Westbrook Mill, people talked about when they were kids coming into the mill and bringing in lunch for their dad. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we may not have that same close connection now, but we try to. You know, we have sent soccer balls to everybody, you know, at the mill so they can go home and talk about, you know, where this paper eventually winds up to. So it is a great history, and whole families were involved, and it's been great.
You know, and, you know, one of the rich things about those My Maine stories that we've collected those thus far, and you can hear in the audience callers, is these Maine stories they're telling. And they're immigrant stories about coming from Canada and Italy and Poland. And it's about acclimating and where Maine was inviting and open and tolerant and where there was resistance. And taking the theme of the taking the hot lunch to dad is one that comes up again and again. So it's really remarkable honoring those experiences and those memories.
Ben on Facebook asks, can your guest speak to the feasibility of wood laminate products as building materials, specifically their usefulness in building low-cost road stream crossings?
Wow. Wood can be used pretty much any place. I think one of the things that we're very excited, Steve Shaler up at the University of Maine works on cross-laminated timber, and the idea there is to take thin strips of wood and glue them together under high pressure, and you could build a skyscraper out of that. And so why use steel or why use concrete when you could use wood for that purpose? Definitely wood is used in applications in across streams as well. I think there's really a great future for opportunities in bigger commercial style buildings, which we're also going after aggressively.
Pat writes an email. He says, thank you for Steve's point that it's important to take time to acknowledge the human aspects involved in what we've experienced as the cultural emergency that the mill closures are. In this regard, I wish to call your attention to our community anthology just out from North Country Press in Unity, entitled Still Mill, Poems, Songs, Stories of Making Paper in Bucksport, Maine, 1930 to 2014. This book is included in the Maine Historical Society's exhibit and available through their museum stores. And it says there are contributions from former paper makers, their families, people from near and far with connections to the mill, both the good and the hard, documenting the birth and evolution of a world-class papermaking culture and the shocking, sudden destruction of that whole culture as told by generations of people. Go ahead, Steve.
No. Waiting for your prompt. No, you know, I think, again, I just want to emphasize, you know, not a lot, maybe not so many listeners are going to be able to physically get in, but the amount of material and stories and historical tales of different communities and the kind of paper they made, from Monopoly paper to fancy doilies on down the line, is really rich. So, you know, there's materials on there that have been contributed by dozens of organizations around the state, so you can get a lot of local stories and experiences. As I was mentioning to you, to me, one of the favorite things that's featured in the exhibit is we recently got a collection of a couple hundred maps and engineering drawings and other documents from Great Northern Paper from the 1920s and 30s, and those are remarkable for illustrating just the diversity of work and how the wealth that was the economy that was driven for it. There are these incredible survey maps of almost every segment of the Maine woods that go out and they document what kinds of tree stands were there, how much they were, what their potential value were. There are documents that almost look like Excel spreadsheets, but they're handwritten charts that list each kind of tree type, back to the question earlier, what its board feet was, what its potential value is, what it would take to extract it from the woods. So the sophistication of the economy that went on around there and its scale and reach was really pretty remarkable. Yeah. So there's a lot of rich historical material related to this.
I really want to thank the Maine Historical Society and Steve as its leader for recognizing the industry, the tremendous impact that they've had on the state, the unsung heroes who've worked in the mills and created that whole culture. And I hope we can build on that and really take a look at the new Maine forest economy. And it will be different, but it's still going to be vibrant.
Well, let me ask you this, Donna. You know, I mentioned at the top of the program that at its peak, 18,000 people were employed by paper mills in Maine. Are we headed back to 18,000 someday, or does automation and technology make that unlikely?
Always hard to say, because we don't know who's going to come in or how much the growth is going to be on some of these new opportunities that we have. I think if you took a look at the peak numbers, they were before some of the automation came in, and there's always going to be a recognition of investing in capital and trying to do things more efficiently. The mills that have been the winners are the ones who invested and who were in a very low cost range to make their product. But I do think that it is just going to be different, and maybe it will be located in different areas of Maine than traditionally we've been located before.
Do you see, despite the terrible news in the past 5 years, do you see growth in the future?
What I see is the growth of new products, whether that translates into a lot more jobs or stabilizes jobs. I really can't predict that. But I absolutely see investment in the Maine forest because it's so unique. The private ownership, the size of it. I haven't talked much about the infrastructure, but the loggers that we have, you know, the history of the whole supply chain to make us successful is very difficult to duplicate. And again, we're close to New York. We're close to all that mid-Atlantic. I think we just need some recovery time, and again, we'll look a lot different. So we'll have to do this show in a few years and see how we've progressed, Jennifer.
One of the things to me that has been amazing, Donna, is just the health of the Maine woods. And we tell this story of industrialization over 100 years and cutting and reuse of rivers. But, you know, it was through the paper industry in part that Maine became a national leader in the environmental movement in the 1970s. Another important partner in this project has been the Forest Society of Maine, who has, you know, helped get millions of acres of wood under conservation. And so one of my favorite images in the exhibit is a vast color high-level panoramic photo of the Maine woods and just how extensive and healthy it is as a foundation for going forward.
Okay, well, if you want to see that exhibit, it's up till October 28th at the Maine Historical Society. Thank you both for being here. Steve Bromage is the Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society, and Donna Cassese is Managing Director of Wood Resource Strategy at SAPI North America. Roddy Nickbor ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and our archives at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. For those of you in Aroostook County, please come see us. We'll be in Fort Kent Monday, Presque Isle Tuesday and Wednesday, and Houlton on Thursday. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.